Chapter 4. Dependent Liberation. Monks, one who is virtuous need not wish, may I be free from remorse? It is natural that the virtuous are free from remorse. One who is free from remorse need not wish, may I be glad? It is natural that in one free from remorse, gladness arises. One who is glad need not wish, may I feel rapture? It is natural that one who is glad feels rapture. One who feels rapture need not wish, may my body be tranquil. It is natural that one who feels rapture has a tranquil body. In one whose body is tranquil need not wish, may I feel bliss. It is natural that one whose body is tranquil feels bliss. One who is blissful need not wish, may my mind be concentrated in samadhi. It is natural that one who is blissful has samadhi. One who has samadhi need not wish, may I know and see in line with reality. It is natural that one who has samadhi knows and sees in line with reality. One who knows and sees in line with reality need not wish, may I be repulsed. It is natural that one who knows and sees is repulsed. One who is repulsed need not wish, may lust fade away. It is natural that lust fades away in one who is repulsed. One whose lust has faded away need not wish, may I witness the knowledge of vision and release. It is natural that one whose lust has faded away witnesses the knowledge and vision of release. Thus, monks, dhammas flow on to and fulfill dhammas for crossing over from the near to the far shore. The Buddha, Anguttara Nikaya 11.2. Causality. Enlightenment is no accident. It emerges from a precisely defined set of conditions, which are frequently depicted in the suttas. There is no widely used term for this doctrinal framework, so I have coined the term dependent liberation. Elsewhere it has been called transcendental dependent origination. Many versions occur in the suttas, but with a common pattern displaying the conditional unfolding of liberation as an evolution of ever more refined qualities. All of the variations follow the sequence of virtue, samadhi, and wisdom. Often these broad categories are subdivided, revealing their inner structure as comprised of further conditional sequences. Such passages as the above, which treat the samadhi section in most detail, occur throughout the suttas. Some understanding of the principles of causality is essential to fully appreciate the significance of this teaching. Causes can be analyzed as two kinds, necessary conditions and sufficient conditions. A necessary condition is one whose absence makes it impossible for the result to occur. For example, a necessary condition of being a woman is being a human being. If one is not a human being, it is impossible to be a woman. A sufficient condition is one whose presence makes it inevitable that the result will occur. For example, a sufficient condition of being a human being is being a woman. If one is a woman, it definitely follows that one is a human being. The two need not, as in the examples above, be exclusive. For example, a necessary and sufficient condition for being a human being is being a featherless biped. If one is not a featherless biped, one cannot be a human being. And if one is a featherless biped, it definitely follows that one is a human being. Or, the condition may be neither necessary nor sufficient. For example, being a boy is neither necessary nor sufficient condition for becoming an adult human being, but merely conducive. This distinction is critical. If in the thought world of the suttas, X is a condition for Y means that X is a sufficient condition for Y, this leaves open the question whether other things may also be sufficient. Virtue, samadhi, and understanding lead to nibbana. But there may be another or a myriad of other paths up the same mountain. If, however, X is a condition for Y means that X is a necessary condition for Y, we must regard all X, each of the factors subsumed within such a causal relationship, as being indispensable. For which alternative applies to the sutta's teachings on causality? Let us start with the most general formula for causality independent origination, known as specific conditionality. Samyutta Nikaya 12:37, etc. When this exists, that is. Due to the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that is not. Due to the cessation of this, that ceases. The first pair of principles appears to imply sufficient conditionality. If something exists, another thing comes to be. However, a close contextual examination reveals that this is not so. Here is one example where someone possessed of an earlier condition for spiritual progress, ethical conduct, does not realize the higher states. The noble disciple, content with the virtues beloved of the noble ones, does not try further for seclusion by day and retreat by night. Abiding thus negligent, gladness does not arise. When there is no gladness, there is no rapture. When there is no rapture, there is no tranquility. When there is no tranquility, he abides in suffering. The mind of one who suffers does not enter samadhi. Dhammas do not manifest in a mind without samadhi. Because dhammas do not manifest, he is called an abider in negligence. Samyutta Nikaya 55:40. If such consequences were based on a concept of sufficient conditionality, there would be no point in making an effort, for an ethical person would naturally gain samadhi, whether or not they actually meditated. This is not an isolated example. In the standard sequence of dependent origination, it is said that feeling is the condition for craving. If feeling were a sufficient condition for craving, then no one, including the Buddha, would be exempt from craving. All spiritual practice would be ineffectual. There are, in fact, many conditions left unstated in these contexts. It is fundamental to Buddhist causality that many factors are present at all times, interacting in complex ways. The suttas do not claim to offer a complete analysis of every factor at all times. Rather, they point to what is useful, what is necessary. In the context of practice, the notion of sufficient condition applies only in that a noble disciple must eventually attain liberation, even if, as above, they are mightily negligent. If the main connections spoken of in Buddhism are not sufficient conditions, then should they be seen as necessary conditions? The relation of necessity is, in fact, one that is specified in many passages. Here is one example in the context of dependent origination. If there were not the birth of those various kinds of beings into the various states of existence, when all kinds of birth do not exist, due to the cessation of birth, would aging and death be found? No, Bhante. Digha Nikaya 15:4. Quite clearly, birth is a necessary condition for aging and death. It is true that birth is also a sufficient condition for death, however, it is not a sufficient condition for aging, because a being who has been newly born might die immediately before aging. So, the notion of sufficiency cannot be inherent in the causal specification. It must be inferred from context. Below, we shall see the kinship between dependent origination and dependent liberation, like an image and its reflection, expressed in various ways in the suttas. And just as causality in dependent origination is primarily necessary conditionality, all the main similes illustrating dependent liberation likewise imply necessity. The rain filling the mountain streams, the leaves sustaining the tree, or each stage of a journey bringing one to the next. Similar similes are applied to dependent origination at Samyutta Nikaya 12:23 and others. This means that these passages embody an invariable law of nature. Unless these conditions are fulfilled, it is impossible that the result can occur. Our first passage above, however, shows a more active process than mere necessity. The previous conditions do not merely allow subsequent conditions to arise, they are an energy that actively promotes the arising. The main emphasis is not the absence of the conditions immediately destroys the resultant phenomena, but that without the supporting conditions, the results are not nourished to fulfillment. Although this does not apply to all causal relationships found in the suttas, it is an important aspect of the context dealing with practice. They have a direction, a forward impetus. Following the way of the world, the sequence of dependent origination, starting from ignorance, one is swept along the stream of birth, aging, and death. But the sequence, starting with faith and virtue, will sweep one along to nibbana. Some writers have tried to reduce Buddhist conditionality to the mutuality condition, that is, when two factors act as a mutual support for each other, as when two sheaves of straw lean against one another. If all Buddhist conditions were mutual, then this would apply to samatha and vipassana as well. They would be entirely equal partners. But this type of condition, though important, is restricted to a few contexts. In many contexts, this relation is expressly denied. Samyutta Nikaya 14, 3, 5, 8, and 10. It would be difficult to establish from the suttas that the normal expressions for conditional relations can mean, in and of themselves, conascent, or mutuality conditions. The few occasions where such a relation is discussed emphasize how obtruse and unusual this is regarded. For example, Digha Nikaya 15:21-22 and others. And even here, the standard conditional clause does not alone bear the burden of expressing two-way conditionality. Conascence is explained instead with two separate mirror image statements of one-way conditionality. This lack of full mutuality is emphasized in the relationship between samadhi and wisdom. In the Potapada Sutta, the Buddha first describes perception in terms of the successive refinements of perception through the jhanas leading to insight knowledge. This passage deals with the relation between perception, how things seem, which arises in samadhi, and knowledge, how things are, which is vipassana. But, Bhante, does perception arise first and knowledge afterward, or does knowledge arise first and perception afterward? Perception, Potapada, arises first, knowledge afterward. Due to the arising of perception, there is the arising of knowledge. One understands thus. It seems that my knowledge arose due to that condition. Digha Nikaya 9:20. In this kind of relationship, the earlier quality is a necessary condition for the latter. The later quality can then support and reinforce the earlier developed quality. But it is never in a fully mutual or equal relationship. This is like a mother's relationship with her child. A child, as they mature, may give their mother as much support and help as they are able, but can never repay the gift of life. Similarly, wisdom can act as a supporting condition to deepen clarity of awareness, but can only see its way to do so dependent on clarity already present. So, although we have said again and again these two qualities are closely connected and mutually supportive, it is nevertheless the case that samadhi is, in the final analysis, preliminary to the wisdom of realization. Still, wisdom can and indeed must be developed from the beginning of the practice. Three main modes of the wisdom which precedes samadhi can be discerned. Firstly, conceptual understanding from hearing and reflecting on the teachings. Second, investigation into the causes of samadhi. Third, vipassana proper, the clear-eyed discernment of conditioned reality. Now, obviously these three aspects are closely linked, and the mention of any of them in a particular context should normally be understood by way of emphasis, not exclusion. A thread unifying all these modes is that wisdom is described in some sort of relation to samadhi, not apart from it. This preliminary understanding serves various preparatory functions, but only with the ripening of the other path factors does it mature into the wisdom that really counts, knowledge and vision in accordance with reality. It is, monks, just like a house with a peaked roof. As long as the roof peak has not been set in place, the rafters are not steady, not stable. But when the roof peak has been set in place, then the rafters are steady and stable. So too, as long as noble knowledge has not arisen in the noble disciple, the other four spiritual faculties are not steady, not stable. But when noble knowledge has arisen in the noble disciple, the other four spiritual faculties are steady and stable. Samyutta Nikaya 48:52. The rafters of faith, energy, mindfulness, and samadhi must be set up before the roof peak of noble understanding can be set in place. They are the necessary antecedent conditions for liberating wisdom. Understanding, in its turn, fortifies and firmly fixes the four already existing faculties. This kind of feedback loop may have quite a general application. Any subsequent quality can strengthen previously developed qualities. However, this should not distract from the prevailing paradigm of sequential conditions. Hence, the sutta states quite clearly that one could fulfill the aggregate of understanding without having fulfilled the aggregate of samadhi. That is not possible. Anguttara Nikaya 5.22. There's no equivalent passage stating that development of understanding must be fulfilled before one gains samadhi. These considerations point to an understanding of causality that is definite and structured. The Buddha did not teach causality with such philosophical pleasantries as everything is interrelated. He taught specific conditionality. This is the cause of that. The same patterns occur over and over. Craving is the cause of suffering, but just as the lotus grows in the mud, the experience of suffering is the essential motivation for the spiritual practice which will end suffering. In the Upanisa Sutta, the connection between the normal dependent origination and the liberating sequence is made explicit. Samyutta Nikaya 12.23. The sequence starts out as usual with ignorance leading up to birth and suffering, but suffering gives rise not to despair, but to faith. This emotional conviction then triggers the same sequence of joy, rapture, tranquility, bliss, samadhi, insight, and release that was described above, beginning with virtue. Note, in the spiritual faculties, virtue is included in faith, Samyutta Nikaya 48.8 and others. The sequence of 12 factors beginning with suffering is the positive counterpoint of the 12 factors of the cessation mode of the normal dependent origination. Intriguingly, dependent origination in the mode of origination is called the wrong way of practice, just as the wrong Eightfold Path, while the mode of cessation is called the right way of practice, just as the right Eightfold Path. This collapses the distinction between theory and practice, between the middle teaching and the middle way. Samyutta Nikaya 12.3 and 45.23. The Mahanidana Sutta also describes the ending of suffering in positive terms by focusing on two kinds of arahants, Digha Nikaya 15.33. The first is released by understanding. Here, there is described as understanding the origin, ending, gratification, danger, and escape in the case of the seven stations of consciousness and two bases. These are all planes into which rebirth can occur depending on the level of development of consciousness, with particular emphasis on meditative attainments. Here, the identity is clear between consciousness as a link in dependent origination, as the mind states developed in meditation, and as the stream of consciousness flowing on to rebirth in the various worlds. The second kind of arahant is the both sides released, who is distinguished by fluency in all the meditative attainments. Thus, the transparent mind of samadhi has a key role throughout in unraveling the tangle of samsara. This dependent origination is profound and appears profound. Not awakening to and not penetrating this principle, this generation has become like a tangled ball of string, matted in a bird's nest, entangled like a mass of coarse grass, and does not evolve beyond lower realms, bad destinies, the abyss, and samsara. Digha Nikaya 15.1. A tangled ball of string will never untie itself, and so too the mind entangled in worldly affairs will never loosen the knot of suffering. The key difference between enlightened and unenlightened beings is their sincerity of devotion to spiritual practice. For the fool, as for the sage, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, this conscious body has been acquired. Thus, there is the duality of this body and the external mentality and physical form. Dependent on this duality, there is contact. There are just six sense bases, contacted through which, or through one of them, the fool and the sage experience pleasure and pain. What then is the difference, the distinction between the fool and the sage? For the fool, this ignorance has not been abandoned and this craving has not been evaporated. For what reason? Because the fool has not lived the holy life for the complete evaporation of suffering. Therefore, with the breakup of the body, the fool passes on to a new body. He is not released from birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, bodily pain, mental suffering, and despair. He is not released from suffering, I say. But for the sage, this ignorance has been abandoned, and this craving has been evaporated. For what reason? Because the sage has lived the holy life for the complete evaporation of suffering. Therefore, with the breakup of the body, the sage does not pass on to a new body. He is released from birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, bodily pain, mental suffering, and despair. He is released from suffering, I say. This is the distinction, the difference between the fool and the sage, that is, living the holy life. Samyutta Nikaya 12:19. The holy life is usually identified as the Noble Eightfold Path, Samyutta Nikaya 45:39. Its application in this context is illustrated in the Maha Tanha Sanghaya Sutta. This is one of the most important discourses on dependent origination, set up specifically to refute the view that it is this very same consciousness that fares on through the round of rebirths. It is one of the contexts which suggests that the word consciousness was established pre-Buddhist parlance for the principle underlying rebirth. As he often did, the Buddha accepted the conventional terminology but redefined it, insisting that consciousness arises according to conditions. The Buddha also takes over a Brahmanical view that reincarnation of the embryo occurs concurrent with three things: the coming together of the mother and father, the mother is fertile, and the being to be reborn is present. See Majjhima Nikaya 93:18. Having taken rebirth, one is nourished by the mother, plays childish games, and, as the sense faculties mature, engages in favoring and opposing feelings, giving rise to craving and future rebirth. The round of cessation is shown with a full gradual training for the appearance of the Tathagata and the going forth to the abandoning of the hindrances. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, taints of the mind which rob understanding of its strength, he enters and abides in the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Seeing a visible form with the eye, he does not lust for pleasant-seeming visible forms. He abides with mindfulness of the body established, with an immeasurable heart, and he understands in accordance with reality the release of heart, release by understanding, where these evil, unbeneficial phenomena cease without remainder. Having thus abandoned favoring and opposing, whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, he does not relish, welcome, or remain attached to it. The relishing of feelings ceases in him. Due to the cessation of his relishing, grasping ceases. Due to the cessation of grasping, ongoing existence ceases. Due to the cessation of existence, birth ceases. Due to the cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, bodily pain, mental suffering, and despair cease. Thus, there is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering, and so on for the ear, etc. Majjhima Nikaya 38. Something of the profound relationship between the evolving sequence of Dhammas, beginning with faith or virtue, and the core of the Dhamma is beginning to emerge, how this process is both necessary for and powerfully inducive to liberation. I have coined the term vital condition to bring out these two aspects. Monks, when there is no mindfulness and clear comprehension, in one without mindfulness and clear comprehension, the vital condition for conscience and fear of wrongdoing is destroyed. When there is no conscience and fear of wrongdoing, the vital condition for sense restraint is destroyed. When there is no sense restraint, the vital condition for virtue is destroyed. When there is no virtue, the vital condition for right samadhi is destroyed. When there is no right samadhi, in one without right samadhi, the vital condition for knowledge and vision in accordance with reality is destroyed. When there is no knowledge and vision in accordance with reality, the vital condition for repulsion and fading away is destroyed. When there is no repulsion and fading away, the vital condition for knowledge and vision of release is destroyed. Just as, monks, when a tree is without leaves and twigs, the branches, bark, sapwood, and heartwood do not come to fulfillment. Anguttara Nikaya 8:81, and many others. The critical link here is between right samadhi, jhana, and knowledge and vision in accordance with reality. This phrase refers to the stream enterer's vision of the Dhamma. In other words, this passage says that jhana is a necessary condition for stream entry. Note, it does not, however, in and of itself confirm the necessity of jhana for those on the way to stream entry, since they do not have knowledge and vision in accordance with reality. See Samyutta Nikaya 25.1. More on these path attainers below. It is quite striking that in this, as well as in other passages, there is no clear mention of vipassana. The commentaries treat knowledge and vision in accordance with reality as immature vipassana, but this cannot be so since immature vipassana may be developed prior to jhana, whereas here we are told that jhana is a vital condition. Vipassana as such seems to be one of the unstated factors in such sequences. This passage further clarifies two points in the interpretation of other descriptions of dependent liberation, or the path in general. Firstly, samadhi as a crucial support for liberation means right samadhi, which is the four jhanas. When we came across other descriptions of the path that refer to or imply samadhi in less explicit terms, we should therefore infer that jhana is meant. This is the normal situation in the suttas, since the sequence gladness, rapture, tranquility, bliss, and samadhi elsewhere serves to introduce the four jhanas. Diganikaya 2.25, etc. Sometimes, too, the divine beings, Majjhima Nikaya 7.8. Or else it develops the spiritual faculties, powers, and enlightenment factors. Secondly, this right samadhi is an essential component of the path, not an optional extra. In contexts such as the gradual training, which include extras such as psychic powers, we must therefore understand that samadhi, no less than virtue or wisdom, cannot be skipped over. The Seven Purifications. The seven purifications shed further light on dependent liberation. They occur only once in the suttas, and once again with two further purifications addended, and are not analyzed in detail. Although of slight importance in the suttas, they were utilized as the framework of the Visuddhimagga, thus assuming great importance for the Theravadin exegetical tradition. Here, virtue and samadhi are treated summarily, the focus being on a more detailed breakdown of the stages of insight. This trend continues further in the Patthisamvidda-magga and further still in the Visuddhimagga. Perhaps for this reason, the seven purifications have played a key role in the attempts to discover a vehicle of pure vipassana in the suttas. I will endeavor to piece together what the suttas say about these stages. First, the basic statement from the primary source, the Ratta Vinita Sutta. Purification of virtue is for the sake of purification of mind. Purification of mind is for the sake of purification of view. Purification of view is for the sake of purification of overcoming uncertainty. Purification of overcoming uncertainty is for the sake of purification of knowledge and vision of what is and what is not the path. Purification of knowledge and vision of what is and what is not the path is for the sake of purification of knowledge and vision of the way. Purification of knowledge and vision of the way is for the sake of purification of knowledge and vision. Purification of knowledge and vision is for the sake of final nibbana without grasping. Majjhima Nikaya 24.15. The sutta gives the simile of a journey by means of relay carriages. The first carriage takes one as far as the second carriage, but no further. The second carriage takes one as far as the third, but no further. Each carriage has a specific role to play which cannot be omitted. As usual, the stages are both necessary and helpful conditions, but not sufficient. The individual stages are not defined in the Ratta Vinita Sutta, so we must look elsewhere. A related teaching by Venerable Ananda provides explanations of some factors. The stages of purification are here shown not as self-sufficient, but as supported by a phalanx of ancillary factors. Though wisdom is at work throughout, only after purification of mind, which is always explicitly defined as the four jhanas, does it mature into knowledge and vision in accordance with reality. And why, Vyagyapajas, is the factor of striving in the purification of virtue? Here a monk is virtuous. He trains in the rules of training he has undertaken. This is called purification of virtue. He thinks, I will fulfill such a form of purification when it is unfulfilled, or when it is fulfilled. I will assist it everywhere with understanding. the enthusiasm therein, the effort, the industry, the endeavor, the not holding back, the mindfulness, and the clear comprehension, this is called the factor of striving in the purification of virtue. And what, Vyagapajas, is the factor of striving in the purification of mind? Here a monk enters and abides in the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. This is called purification of mind. The enthusiasm, etc., therein, this is called the factor of striving in the purification of mind. And what, Vyagapajas, is the factor of striving in the purification of view? Here a monk understands in accordance with reality. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called purification of view. The enthusiasm, etc., therein. This is called the factor of striving in the purification of view. And what, Vyagapajas, is the factor of striving in the purification of release? The noble disciple, endowed with the factor of striving in the purification of virtue, of mind, of view, makes lust fade from his mind regarding phenomena provoking lust, and makes his mind release from phenomena which should be released from. Having done so, he contacts right release. This is called purification of release. He thinks, I will fulfill such a purification when it is unfulfilled or when it is fulfilled. I will assist it everywhere with understanding. The enthusiasm therein, the effort, the industry, the endeavor, the not holding back, the mindfulness and the clear comprehension, this is called the factor of striving in the purification of release. Anguttara Nikaya 4.194. In this sequence, purification of view is the vision of the Four Noble Truths, which, as we have noted above, is normally associated with the stream enterer. Purification of view in this group of four occupies the same place where the seven purifications mention three factors: purification of view, of overcoming uncertainty, and of knowledge and vision of what is and what is not the path. These correspond exactly with the three fetters abandoned by the stream enterer: identity view, doubt, and misapprehension of virtue and vows. A possible reading is that these three purifications constitute an expanded explanation of purification of view, detailing the sequence in which these fetters are abandoned during the course of vipassana, culminating in the vision of the Four Noble Truths. Having clearly seen what the path is, the stream enterer is in a position to perfect their purification of knowledge and vision of the way. This occupies the equivalent position in this sequence as do repulsion and fading away elsewhere. We noted earlier that these pertain exclusively to the noble stages. And in the above passage too, the text changes from monk to noble disciple for the final purification, the fading away of lust after seeing the Four Noble Truths. The development of insight culminates with the purification of knowledge and vision. Here surely the knowledge and vision of release pertaining to arahantship. The commentarial notion that these seven stages are completed by the stream enterer and that the higher path attainers go around again, each time repeating the sequence of vipassana knowledges, Visuddhimagga 22.22, finds no support in the suttas and contradicts the basic texts and similes, which speak of a one-way, step-by-step progression. The purpose of developing purification of knowledge and vision is not for the further purification of insight through the higher paths, but for final nibbana without grasping. Now, it is true that in real life things are not so straightforward, and Buddhist causality hinges on these nuances and ramifications. But this does not empower us to simply postulate interpretations without a textual basis. The Ratha Vinita sequences is clearly meant to express the primary conditional sequence of practice, to which other elements, supplementary factors, feedback loops, etc., should be considered as subordinate. This interpretation is somewhat complicated by the nine purifications mentioned in the Dasuttara Sutta, which add purification of understanding and purification of release to the seven, Digha-Nikaya 34.22. These two extras, occurring only in this late and formalistic sutta, may perhaps be read as an expanded explanation of purification of knowledge and vision. The exact interpretation of the stages of liberating insight, though, does not affect the necessity for jhana as the purification of mind that precedes all these stages. Purification of view can be described from different angles. A certain monk approached another monk and asked, "What does well-purified vision refer to?" The monk replied, "When a monk understands in accordance with reality the origin and ending of the six bases of contact." Dissatisfied with that explanation, he approached another monk who said, "When a monk understands the five aggregates." And another monk said, "When a monk understands the four great elements." And yet another said, "When a monk understands in accordance with reality, whatever is subject to arising, all that is subject to cessation." That is what well-purified vision refers to. Dissatisfied with all these answers, the monk approached the Blessed One, who replied, "Each of those true men explained how vision is well-purified according to their dispositions, in just the same way that their own vision has been purified." Samyutta Nikaya 35-245, condensed. The Buddha then went on to present the simile of the city given above, showing that all of these modes of seeing reality are delivered to the mind by samatha and vipassana. Purification by overcoming uncertainty refers to doubts such as, "Was I in the past? How was I? Will I be in the future?" All such speculation is ultimately based on the false notion of a permanent self. Seeing the monk Revata the doubter reviewing his purification by overcoming uncertainty, the Buddha remarked, "Whatever uncertainties about here or beyond, one's own or another's feelings about views, the liver of the holy life abandons them all, ardently practicing jhana." Udana 5.7. The Buddha's first inspired utterance after his enlightenment describes how he overcame doubt through discernment of conditions. Emerging from 7 days samadhi absorbed in the bliss of liberation, he reflected on dependent origination and spoke the following verses. When dhammas fully manifest to the ardent Brahman in jhana, then his doubts all disappear, since he has understood dhammas and their causes. When dhammas fully manifest to the ardent Brahman in jhana, then his doubts all disappear, since he has realized the evaporation of conditions. When dhammas fully manifest to the ardent Brahman in jhana, he stands dispelling Mara's hordes like the sun which lights the sky. Udana 1:1-3. Knowledge and vision of what is and what is not the path seems to occur in only one other passage. In this passage, the word universal is a technical term for samadhi based on perception of an element or color. Note, the Pali kasina, but in the suttas, this does not mean a disc of color or elements used as a support for preliminary meditation, as described in the Visuddhimagga. See Appendix A for a discussion. This was spoken by the Blessed One in the girl's questions. The attainment of the goal, the peace of the heart, having conquered the army, dear and pleasant seeming, alone, doing jhana, I awakened to bliss. Therefore, I make no partners with people. Partnership with anyone is not for me. Bhante, how should the detailed meaning of this brief statement by the Blessed One be regarded? Sister, some contemplatives and Brahmins, excelling in the attainment of the earth universal, came up with that as the goal. But the extent of excellence in the attainment of the earth universal was directly known by the Blessed One. Directly knowing thus, he saw the beginning, the danger, the escape, and the knowledge and vision of what is and what is not the path. For him, because of seeing these things, the attainment of the goal, the peace of the heart, is known. And so on for the other nine universals, concluding with the consciousness universal. So this knowledge involves developing insight into samadhi based on direct experience. The seven purifications thus involve samadhi, not simply as the precondition for insight at purification of mind, but at each step of the development of insight, specifically including the stages of insight pertaining to stream entry. Conclusion. In this chapter, we have delved into the nature of the conditional relations governing the path of practice. The path embodies the principles of the Dhamma in practical form. The practice and theory of Dhamma can only be provisionally separated. For the sincere practitioner, their every moment is a reflection of Dhamma. The sincerity they find in their daily life and in their meditation is the experiential proof of the drying up of the flood of defilements. The next chapter shows how these principles find expression in the life of contemplative simplicity. When the sky pours down rain in big drops on the mountaintop, the water flows down and fills the mountain cracks and crevices. When the mountain cracks and crevices are full, they fill the little pools. When the little pools are full, they fill the great pools. When the great pools are full, they fill the little rivers. When the little rivers are full, they fill the great rivers. When the great rivers are full, they fill the mighty ocean.